to the ice sheet height levels of the last century's Bohr set. So, practically, the current and near-future mass loss will be largely irreversible. That's why it is high time we rapidly and substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels and re-stabilize the ice sheet and our climate. The AMOC is a system of ocean currents that redistribute heat across the planet and is being closely monitored for changes by scientists around the world. Scientists estimate that the AMOC and one of its well-known components, the Gulf Stream, control roughly one quarter of the heat transfer in the Northern Hemisphere. Due to warming temperatures and melting sea ice, scientists have discovered that the AMOC is experiencing an unprecedented slowdown, one that has not been witnessed for over 1,000 years. Many factors such as greenhouse gas emissions, land use change, and volcanic eruptions have an impact on the Greenland ice sheet, and this study concludes that more research needs to be done to narrow down the conditions that would most likely contribute to an irreversible melting of the ice sheet.
We get people.
U.S. agenda on Iran.
More than 4 months into the year 2021, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has failed to return to the internationally backed nuclear deal with Iran. While indirect negotiations continue, Washington is attempting to take the upper hand by demands that make no sense, considering the U.S. violation of the deal under former President Trump.
President Biden has been very clear in saying that if Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same thing.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamagni. In this show, we will take an analytical look at the latest developments in relation to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. What could you expect to come out of the indirect talks in Vienna? Is the U.S. ready to show some respect after violating the deal? We'll try to find out. Stay with us on We the People.
Our overarching goal is to ensure that Iran's nuclear program is permanently and verifiably constrained, and that on a permanent and verifiable basis, Iran will not be able to obtain a nuclear weapon.
Whether the Joint Commission's agenda produces a result or not depends on the Europeans and reminding the U.S. of its obligations and the Americans acting on their commitments.
The stakes are high as the U.S. hesitates to return to the deal. The outcome of the talks will determine not just the future of the dynamics between Tehran and Washington, but also the durability of security in the whole region. The U.S. industrial military is rarely ready to give an inch when it comes to its financial and adventurous interests, mostly under Israeli influence.
The cabinet is united in strongly opposing the proposed deal. This deal would pose a grave danger to the region and to the world, and would threaten the very survival of the state of Israel. The deal would not shut down a single nuclear facility in Iran, would not destroy a single centrifuge in Iran, and will not stop R&D on Iran's advanced centrifuges. On the contrary, The deal would legitimize Iran's illegal nuclear program. It would leave Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure.
In this case, Washington is refusing to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, although it had basically violated international law by withdrawing. Tehran has so far taken methodical retaliatory measures to respond to the US isolationism within the JCPOA framework. We're now joined by Daniel Kovalik, author, peace activist, and professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Professor Kovalik, how do you think it's justified for the Biden administration not to lift the sanctions illegally imposed by former President Trump?
Well, I think it was wrong. I mean, I think he should have lifted sanctions right away and entered the nuclear deal that Trump backed out of, entered it without conditions. He hasn't done that. We'll see if he does enter that agreement again. I'm critical of that. I'm critical of the fact that he has continued to bomb Somalia, that he's continued to intervene in Syria. So he has a long way to go, certainly.
Many thanks for your insight, Professor Kovalik. Stay tuned.
Tehran has demanded that it would only reverse its remedial measures, the phased reduction of its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA, if the U.S. removes all sanctions together. The U.S., meanwhile, appears to be under Israel's pressure, as is the case oftentimes, to make sure the U.S. administration would not take any action against Tel Aviv's interests.
That has complicated the indirect Tehran-Washington talks even further. Israel has also been stepping up aggression against Palestinians. Tel Aviv has been pressuring the Biden administration through its lobbies in Washington to make sure Tehran cannot win its absolute right as defined in the nuclear deal. Our next guest is Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and a former US Marine intelligence officer. He's the author of the book Deal Breaker, Donald Trump and the Unmaking of the Iran Nuclear Deal. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Mr. Ritter, during the 2016 presidential election, then-candidate Joe Biden vowed to reverse Trump administration's aggressive policies, including foreign policy. How much of that do you think has materialized today? Do you see a major shift in foreign policy?
There's been actually very little separation in terms of operational impact. There's been a rhetorical difference. President Biden has said things to our allies that that give voice to his intent to improve alliances and things of that nature, to rebuild alliances. But at the end of the day, there's been no major shift in foreign policy across the board.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Ritter.
The Israeli regime's aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian lands in the West Bank and elsewhere has also been affecting the dynamics of the Tehran-Washington standoff over the nuclear deal.
Of doing everything we can to make sure that Iran never acquires a nuclear weapon. An Iran with a nuclear weapon or with the capacity to have one on very short order is an Iran that's likely to act with even greater impunity when it comes to these other actions.
Republicans in Congress, for instance, believe that the Hamas resistance movement's retaliatory attacks to defend Palestinians in the face of Israeli aggression is a good reason to cease the talks in Vienna.
The Biden administration, meanwhile, voices mild opposition to the Zionist regime's military adventurism, but at the same time justifies its attitude and at times even aids and abets Tel Aviv. We're also joined by Sayed Mohammad Marandi, political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Marandi, is the U.S. and generally the West, for that matter, seeking to withhold Iran from economic prosperity? Why would a weaker Iran serve their interests better?
Western regimes have a general policy of making countries suffer if they do not abide ratify their demands and their orders. So the United States is imposing maximum pressure on Iranians to make the Iranian nation suffer as much as possible, to force Iran to abide by the will of the empire. But it's not just Iran.
Many thanks for your insight, Professor Mirandi.
The U.S. long-lasting support for Israel is no big surprise. Under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime intends to make sure Iran's nuclear program is disrupted. Iran has been stepping up its nuclear program in return for the illegal sanctions imposed under former President Donald Trump.
Trump was pro-Israel in a more straightforward way. He was also anti-Iran in the same manner as the JCPOA had been negotiated under his nemesis, former President Barack Obama. Today, Biden has a tough job. He could continue pandering to Tel Aviv or just do the right thing in an effort to maybe restore some credibility for the United States' international pledges, such as sticking to a deal.
Again, all they would have had to have done is re-entered the agreement that President Obama had entered into, and they're not doing that. I mean, it makes you wonder whether they just are trying to buy time and that they really don't want to re-enter the deal. So that remains to be seen. I mean, I think that they would like to re-enter it on better terms than Obama did, if they can. And again, maybe they want to leave the option open of not returning to it at all and continuing the pressure on Iran.
As the U.S. procrastinates to return to the deal, the region of West Asia keeps grappling with upheaval and uncertainty. The manufactured crisis in the Middle East could end up with no victory in the U.S. foreign policy sector if the Biden team does not change its course. As Israel spares no efforts to sabotage the Iran nuclear program and negotiations, Tehran remains resolute in remarkable improvement of its nuclear might.
We just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radio isotopes needed for certain medical treatments. The letter and the DIQ has been sent today to the agency, and we would start this important job from tomorrow. Obviously, this is certainly according to our needs.
The former U.S. administration did its best to make a Biden return to the JCPOA next to impossible. And today, as Biden struggles to show a gesture to Iran, he has to deal with not just Israel, but also Trump's past shenanigans. How would the American people and international community feel if the U.S. illogical demands in the talks resulted in a dead end?
We're not the most informed people when it comes to the realities of Iran, its nuclear program, and the efforts that have been underway for some time now to bring them under inspection-based controls. Indeed, the American people have been brainwashed with disinformation put forward by the United States, by the intelligence community in the United States, and by Europe and others who have been painting Iran as a nation that, at a very minimum, sought to acquire nuclear weapons. I mean, that's the accepted narrative today in the United States.
U.S. return to compliance with the nuclear deal is on President Joe Biden. As vice president of the Obama era, Biden played a key role in the 2015 agreement. But can he now bring the United States back to the deal amid the internal power play?
We're negotiating a plan that will have in it a capacity for enforcement. We don't even have diplomatic relations with Iran right now. And the senator's letter erroneously asserts that this is a legally binding plan. It's not. That's number one. Number two, it's incorrect. when it says that Congress could actually modify the terms of an agreement at any time. That's flat wrong. They don't have the right to modify an agreement reached executive to executive between country, between leaders of a country.
As the work on the restoration of the JCPOA continues, there are hopes that the long negotiations would bear tangible results that indicate respect for the Iranian nation. Throughout the 20th century, the US has violated the rights of many nations. That has not changed today. The Biden administration's foreign policy apparatus is expected to consider US reputation not just in regard to Iran, but the whole international community.
I think the international community knows quite well who's to blame. The Iranians have very simple expectations. The Americans abide by the deal in full, and then Iran will abide by the deal in full. In the past, that's not what happened. In the past, during Obama, the Iranians were committed to their side of the bargain, and the Americans weren't. During Trump, of course, it got even worse. So the world knows what's going on, but the problem is that the Western media is never going to condemn the United States. No matter what the United States does, it won't be condemned. There will be no real pressure on the country.
There are no grounds for the West's stated concerns about a nuclear Iran. Both under duress from sanctions and during negotiations, Tehran has always maintained that its nuclear program is merely peaceful. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, went as far as asserting in 2019 that Iran has always had the ability to tread this path, but we declared it haram according to the verdict of the beloved Islam.
اعتقاد به بمب اتم نداریم، به سلاح اتمی نداریم، دنبالش هم نخواهیم رفت. بر طبق مبانی ما، مبانی اعتقادی ما، مبانی دینی ما، به کار بردن این گونه وسایل کشتار جمعی اصلا ممنوعه، حرامه. این ضایع کردن حرص و نسله که قرآن او رو ممنوع کرده.
Assessments by Western monitoring organizations as well as spy agencies have corroborated the peaceful nature of the Iranian program, whereas unquestionably rogue regimes in the region pursue their aggressive and at times nuke-related agenda with impunity.
Well, from the Biden administration's perspective, these sanctions were not illegally imposed. The United States had every right to withdraw from the JCPOA. It was bad policy. But you know, the JCPOA is not a lifelong commitment. Parties are able to withdraw, and the United States withdrew. And in doing so, liberated itself to impose, you know, whatever sanctions it saw fit on Iran. They're consistent with U.S. law. They might be in violation of the law in terms of international law, but even then, that's you know, up for debate.
One could say the Biden administration does not have much leverage with Iran. Tehran has already learned not just to survive, but to prosper despite brutal sanctions meant to cripple the Iranian nation. Biden knows that the previous administration stepped up pressure to the maximum to bring Tehran to its knees, but to no avail.
Today, the ball is in the court of the United States, and Washington has to return and fulfill its obligations.
Now that he is in power, the Democratic president has to realize that his chance for a foreign policy legacy in regard to Iran is short-lived, though currently up for grabs. Can he fight all the anti-Iran sentiments running rampant within the U.S. government and among some allies?
Nothing much has really changed. The United States has a tradition of having a rather stable foreign policy, regardless of who's the president. The general world view of the United States doesn't really change. The United States considers itself to be exceptional. It considers itself to be superior, both morally and, of course, militarily and politically and economically, than other countries. And therefore, they believe that they have special privileges and rights. So while they demand other countries to abide by international law. The United States never abides by international law.
From one perspective, the U.S. dilemma is not a huge one. Washington must simply opt for the right thing to do, which is a return to the JCPOA and removal of all illegal sanctions imposed by Trump.
Our position is very clear. Several countries had clinched an agreement with Iran. This was followed by a UN Security Council resolution. And from our perspective, this is a commitment from all the involved parties in this deal. If the Americans left this accord unilaterally and didn't see fit to deliver on their commitments, this, in our view, is a breach of the principles that are the norms of international behavior. Our view is that if the Americans have any claims on this issue, they have to return to 2015, which is when the accord was agreed on. We can start from there. So the Americans should lift all the imposed sanctions.
On tonight's episode of We the People, I am happy to be joined by Giorgio Caffiero. He is the CEO of Gulf State Analytics. Giorgio, thanks so much for joining us. I want to jump right into it. Negotiations around returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, have stretched on for weeks now, so far with little to show for it, although we've heard plenty of optimism from a number of involved parties. What is the latest here, and what are some of the domestic dynamics in the U.S. that may be complicating or slowing down any attempt to restore the nuclear deal?
Right now, I think we have an administration in the U.S. that genuinely wants to see a revival of the JCPOA. There are, you know, certain questions that are unresolved between the parties, mainly between the U.S. and Iran, about the timing. Obviously, Iran wants as much sanctions relief up front, whereas I think on the U.S. side, they want the sanctions relief to be more gradual, and they want to see it conditioned to certain moves on Iran's side. So we still don't know yet how the Europeans are going to be able to sort of bridge this gap. But nonetheless, I think both the leadership in the U.S. and Iran would like to see the JCPOA once again become an effective accord. However, the Biden administration has some real political headaches here in Washington. The Republican opposition to JCPOA is very, very strong. This nuclear accord has basically become an issue that divides American lawmakers along partisan lines. Republicans are pretty much united with the conviction, the belief that Donald Trump made the best decision in May 2018 when he pulled the U.S. out of the deal unilaterally. So we need to understand that, of course, the Biden administration has the authority to bring the U.S. back into the JCPOA. So this Republican opposition will not in itself block Biden from being able to make that move, but it does complicate the picture. And right now, as we're seeing the massacre that's taking place in Gaza, this violence in Palestine is now becoming increasingly connected to the JCPOA.
I think that's an important point, Giorgio. Could you elaborate on that at all? How exactly does the ongoing siege of Gaza by the so-called Israeli Defense Forces fit into the whole situation here?
The Israeli leadership is really worried about the geopolitical ramifications of a U.S. return to the JCPOA. The nightmare for Netanyahu's government is that tension could decrease between Washington and Tehran if there is a successful revival of the JCPOA. Just to be clear, if the U.S. comes back to the accord, there are still going to be many problems in the U.S.-Iran relationship. But nonetheless, we all know that if the JCPOA is salvaged, there's going to be a real opportunity for the two countries to try to move in move their relationship in a better direction, raising a specter of a real thaw in U.S.-Iran relations. A concern for the Israeli officials is that such a scenario would decrease Israel's strategic value to the United States. And we've seen numerous actions taken by the Israelis. So it's very easy to imagine the Israelis looking at the situation in Gaza as an opportunity to make it increasingly difficult and more politically costly for Joe Biden to do what he needs to do to bring the U.S. back to this accord that the U.S. entered back in 2015 after years and years of negotiations.
That is the only first step that could show a positive gesture to Tehran and indicate seriousness on the side of Washington to de-escalate tensions in the region. With the U.S. sticking to Trump's violation of law today, one could see there is not much difference between Republicans and Democrats, and the U.S. imperialistic agenda moves forward unabated no matter who is residing in the White House.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Studies have shown that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildfire risk, and a longer wildfire season. American people can also expect more heavy rain events and severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like February's polar vortex. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Tara Lohan under the heading, Climate-Driven Extreme Weather is Imperiling Wildlife Conservation Efforts in U.S. The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Hailstorm in southern Texas, tornadoes in Tennessee, wildfires across the western United States, a barrage of Gulf Coast hurricanes. Those are among the record 22 weather and climate disasters that each topped $1 billion in damages last year in the United States. In all, the price tag for 2020 hit a whopping $95 billion. And that's just in the United States. reinsurance firm Swiss Re put global economic losses at $175 billion last year, including $32 billion for floods in China and $13 billion in damages from Cyclone Amphan across India and Bangladesh. The worst news? Americans' profligate burning of fossil fuels means they're in store for more of this. Studies show that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildlife risk, and a longer wildfire season. American people can also expect more heavy rain events and more severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like last February's polar vortex. Bruce Stein, chief scientist and associate vice president at the National Wildlife Federation, says, "You can't attribute any particular storm to climate change, but what we do know is that climate change tips the odds of making many of these events more severe." While experts tabulate the economic losses, homes destroyed, crops ruined, businesses shuttered, the ecosystems and wildlife can also sustain damage that's harder to quantify. Bruce Stein says many plants and wildlife evolved with and have adapted to dealing with large-scale disturbances, but we're beginning to see mega disturbances at levels beyond what we saw in the past. And that can take a toll. Extreme weather can kill animals directly or indirectly, like by destroying food sources, contaminating water, or altering habitat, forcing a species to move into areas where there may be more competition, fewer resources, or a greater risk of predation. The effects of climate change on the natural world are being felt at two speeds. One is more gradual, referred to by scientists as ramping, shrinking glaciers, rising sea levels. The second is quick, like extreme weather events. Sean Maxwell, a postdoctoral research fellow at University of Queensland Centre for Biodiversity and Conservation Science, says both are problematic. But he adds, "I think the changes to acute events have the greatest potential to devastate local populations or ecosystems, and the impacts of these events are often more difficult to plan for or to avoid." Sean Maxwell was the lead author of a 2018 study published in the journal Diversity and Distributions that examined how changes in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather and climate events affected wildlife. The researchers looked at 519 studies of ecological responses to extreme events, including cyclones, droughts, floods, and heat waves and cold waves, that took place from 1941 to 2015. They found that the response was negative 57% of the time, and in those instances where species benefited, they were mostly invasive species. Sean Maxwell says, "Some of the negative responses we found were quite concerning, including more than 100 cases of dramatic population declines and 31 cases of local population extinction following an extreme event," adding, "Populations of critically endangered bird species in Hawaii, such as the palia, have been annihilated due to drought, and populations of lizard species have been wiped out due to cyclones in the Bahamas." The researchers found plant species had the highest number of negative responses to extreme events, followed by reptiles and amphibians. The researchers concluded, "Collectively, the studies in our review suggest that extreme weather and climate events have profound implications for species and ecosystem management." species that are already threatened or endangered are, of course, specially at risk. Take the Atwater prairie chicken, for example. A million of these birds once ranged across the prairies of Texas and Louisiana. Today, fewer than 100 remain in the wild, and scientists have sought to bolster their populations with captive breeding programs. But when Hurricane Harvey walloped Texas with 130-mile-per-hour winds and record rainfall in 2017, the birds were right in harm's way. Other species with limited ranges, like those in islands, also face big threats. In 2017, Hurricane Maria cut the population of just 200 Puerto Rican parrots in half. The year before, Hurricane Matthew was believed to have wiped out the last Bahama nuthatches, or Sitta insularis. According to Diana Bell, a professor of conservation biology at the University of East Anglia in Britain, it took 2 years before a few of the birds were found, and then Hurricane Dorian struck in 2019, making their survival unlikely. Diana Bell wrote in an essay for The Conservation, "In fact, Hurricane Dorian may have not only sealed the fate of the nuthatch, but also severely impacted other birds endemic to these islands, particularly the Bahama warbler and the Abaco parrot," adding, "Also known as the Bahama Amazon parrot, this subspecies uniquely nests in limestone cavities on the ground, which are likely to have been flooded by the storm surge." The risk to wildlife from extreme storms can be compounded by the ramping effects of climate change, too. In other places, extreme weather is an extra blow to species already struggling with other environmental pressures, like habitat loss, invasive species, or pollution. Last year, the world watched in horror as land use management, climate change, and drought helped push Australia's bushfires to a terrifying new level, killing 34 people and burning 37,500 square miles. In the immediate aftermath, one expert put the death toll for wildlife at 1 billion animals lost. Since then, the figure has been revised to 3 billion killed or displaced by the wildfires. A study published in Nature Ecology and Evolution found that the fire impacted the critical habitat of 832 native species, with 70 species losing more than 30% of their natural range. 21 of those were already at risk of extinction. Those that survived could find themselves hard-pressed in future climate disasters. Australia already has one of the highest extinction rates, and the wildfires could limit the capacity of some species to recover in Australia, like the endangered kangaroo island, Donart, and the long-footed potoroo, and threaten others. The study in Nature Ecology and Evolution found Australia's record blazes last year could push the number of endangered species in the country up by 19%. When Hurricane Irma sacked the Florida Keys in 2017, the storm tossed boats ashore and destroyed more than 1,000 homes and left a trail of debris across the islands. It also endangered one of the region's beloved endemic species, the tiny key deer, which today primarily lives on Big Pine Key. Some deer were killed in the storm, and surviving animals face threats to their already limited freshwater supply as the storm surge dumped saline ocean water into the freshwater pools. Island residents responded the way folks often do after a disaster. They offered help to their neighbors. Following Australia's bushfires last year, the country's government jumped to the aid of wildlife by dropping 4,000 pounds of carrots and sweet potatoes to starving brush-tailed rock wallabies who lost the food source in the wildfires. But beyond immediate food and water relief, there's a much bigger task ahead. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions to address the ongoing dangers of climate change and the ability of ecosystems to adapt. For example, Florida key deer also face a long-term threat to their drinking water supply from rising seas, something no number of kiddie pools can repair. And more severe hurricanes are likely in future as well. Sean Maxwell says, as climate change continues to ensure extreme climate and weather events are more and more common, we now need to act to ensure species have the best chance to survive. Adding, wherever possible, high quality and intact habitat areas should be retained, as these are the places where species are most resilient to increasing exposure to extreme events. His study found if such intact habitats doesn't exist, ecological restoration efforts can be used to help species adapt, and the more we know, the better. The researchers of the 2018 paper concluded, incorporating extreme events into climate change, vulnerability assessments and adaptation plans will be challenging, adding, but by doing so, we have a greater chance of arriving at conservation interventions that truly address the full range of climate change impacts, and that could give more species a fighting chance in a changing climate.
Midstream.
It is rain made of fire. This is how the people besieged in Gaza described the dense showers of shells on the sky, the sea, and the earth upon which the flood of devastation fell. Photos of the martyrs and the cries of families from under the rubble of their homes are ceaseless. Children the age of mine hiding behind their parents, their only remaining safe place, chanting a surah from the Holy Quran, hoping from the Lord of Heaven to escape death. As for the hospitals, their corridors turned into hell with the arrival of the martyrs and the wounded in dozens of batches. A paramedic comes out screaming as he just found the bodies of his two younger brothers lying in the fridge. Father at the emergency gate embraces his infant son, the last survivor of his entire family. May our Lord give us patience, Yaba, he says to his wounded little child, collapsing in tears. As for the little boy who joined the procession of his martyr father screaming during the funeral, his voice will continue to haunt this world forever. The number of martyrs is rising insanely inside Gaza with 174 as of Sunday and more than 1,400 wounded. These included 39 children and 22 women since the start of the Israeli aggression last week. Retaliating to Israel's fiery winter and its targeting of children, women, and residential buildings, Israel finds itself surrounded by missiles that have reached deep into the occupied territories in an equation perpetuated by the resistance. Every residential building that is bombed in Gaza will be met by bombing Tel Aviv and the internal occupied territories inhabited by illegal colonial settlers. In the context, the military spokesman for the Al-Qassam Brigades, Abu Ubaidah, confirmed, saying, we have prepared ourselves to bomb Tel Aviv for 6 continuous months in retaliation to Israel's incremental genocide. The Palestinian people do not expect a lesson from anyone on how to resist the occupation. Today, they are teaching us how they deal with frustration, fatigue, and blockade. And they explain for those who want to understand that when there is a will to confront the aggressor, a lot can be achieved. What we are witnessing in terms of military capabilities in Gaza is nothing but the result of years of hard work with a heavy price paid in sweat, blood, and tears. It paid off, though. And be not faint of heart when you seek out the enemy, If you happen to suffer pain, behold, they are also suffering as you suffer. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israeli occupation continues to intensify its aggression to pressure the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip through a series of intense air raids unparalleled in the history of Gaza's struggle with the occupation. In the wake of the painful strikes from the resistance, the occupation lost all sanity, carrying out scores of airstrikes on Gaza with F-16 and F-35 war jets, dropping more than 500 heavy missiles at various targets in the strip on residential areas, media towers, and crossroads, leading to scores of martyrs and injured civilians. To discuss this issue with us from Minnesota is Manar Adli, founder of MinPress News, producer and host of Behind the Headline. Thank you very much for being with us, Manar. Now, the fighting round has intensified between the occupation and the Palestinian resistance inside of the Gaza Strip, as well inside the interior occupied territories. But while the operation is dubbed Al-Quds Sword inside of Gaza, it is passing on steadily with various surprises against their enemy. The latter returns to its masters, genocide, killing civilians, bombing residential areas. This time, not only just residential towers are being wiped out, but entire residential squares, I mean, entire neighborhoods are being flattened down. This is the definition of ethnic cleansing, of genocide. Will resistance retaliation be enough to stop this genocide?
Well, as you described, Marwa, we are witnessing a massacre, an unprecedented massacre and genocide, basically being broadcasted live for the world to witness. And yet Israel continues to face absolutely no consequences. The United States has, Joe Biden, we call him Sleepy Joe Biden, he basically gave just a one-minute response about this massacre that has left over 200 civilians dead, including over 50 children now. That makes up over 40% of the deaths to include children. And so Joe Biden simply came out to say that Israel has a right to defend itself. Defend itself against who? These children? That's who the mainstream corporate media is describing as the militants that Israel has a right to defend itself to. And so because of the gravity of this massacre, because entire families, as you described, are being completely wiped off the map, we're seeing images of, just a baby being rescued from the rubble, whereas the mother, the father, the siblings, the uncles, the aunts, the grandmas, the grandfathers are completely, they've died. They've died in these massacres from Israeli bombs being hit. And so the people of Palestine, and especially in Gaza, are, their blood is boiling. And they have a lot of hope to continue to fight Israel and retaliate and respond through their resistance. Under international law, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves.
Wars can be triggered by an isolated incident, but their cause is always deeper than that. In this case, the trigger was the what's being called upon as an eviction, but it's stealing the land and the homes of the Palestinians in favor for Israeli illegal colonial settlers, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds. This is what started it, including the attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of Islam's holiest sites. Why did this sudden eruption of war outside and inside Israel's occupation borders come as such a shock for apartheid Israel?
Well, I think that, talking about the timeline is really important. We have to break down really how this conflict got started. Obviously, outside of the context that this most recent eruption of violence erupted during the month of Ramadan and Eid, where images of Israeli forces and police were basically pulling Palestinians out of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, who are basically resisting, settlers, Israeli colonial settlers that are coming from New York with Brooklyn accents that want to come and expel these Palestinians from their homes, claiming that they have a heritage there, 2,000 years there, when in reality, these are the Palestinians that have lived in these homes for decades, centuries, and have a historical tie to these homes. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to understand that this is outside of just what has happened in the last week or two. This is about a broader issue of Israeli occupation and ethnic cleansing and genocide that has been taking place for over 75 years now. And the world over is witnessing this ethnic cleansing take place on live TV, and the Palestinian youth are banding together and are basically leading this revolution.
What really pushes my buttons is that the plight of the Palestinian people is always dealt with in a discrimination fashion, discriminatory contempt from the Western regime, from the Western governments in specific, even at the humanitarian level. Why do you think that is happening?
Well, Israel has such a stronghold when it comes to, the world political scene. They have historically been threatening the UN. They have been threatening the ICC that has been trying to hold Israel accountable for war crimes. The Israel lobby is extremely, extremely powerful in the United States, funding U.S. politicians to silence them and to get silence them about the Palestinian cause and to get them to attack and smear Palestinian voices. You know, I was just watching a video last night of a former Israeli minister. I don't remember what her name was, but she was discussing how, you know, anytime Palestinians speak up and revolt, all Israel has to do is use the words anti-Semitism.
Wow.
And she was admitting to this. She said that all we have to do is use the words, the accusation, the label anti-Semitism, and it silences the world over and brings people back to support Israel. Anti-Semitism has been weaponized to silence the Palestinian people, but unfortunately what anti-Semitism, the accusation of anti-Semitism has done is actually increased anti-Semitism against Jews the world over. But that's not the point. The point is that the Israel lobby and the power of the Israel war machine is so powerful that it has now brought in also not just the EU and other Western countries, but it is now brought in through the help of course, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, peace deals and arms deals between Israel and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Morocco, and Sudan. And so Israel is power and influence is now the world over. And so that's why we're seeing even these very lame condemnations coming out of Saudi Arabia and Egypt saying, we condemn Israel. But in reality, they are completely complicit in the crimes that Israel is committing against Palestinians because they are working hand in hand with Israel, not only in Gaza and Palestine to silence and massacre the Palestinian people, but to starve and massacre the people in Yemen. Mm-hmm. And so when Joe Biden comes out and says that we're working with our allies in the region, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, to work with Israel, to find a solution, all Joe Biden is saying is that we as the mass murderers, the U.S. empire, the largest empire the world has ever seen that spreads terror across the world and bloodshed, we are turning to other mass murderers like Saudi Arabia, who's committing a major genocide in Israel, in Yemen, for advice on how to solve this issue. So as long as U.S. imperialism and its proxies reign freely, there will be no justice in Palestine.
Well, it remains to be seen how the internal resistance and the Gaza resistance will work together further in harmony to try and protect Palestine and lead the way for the freedom of Palestine. Well, thank you very much, Manar Adli, founder of Min Press News and producer and host of Behind the Headline, for being with us to discuss this plight against the entire nation of Palestine. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will talk about how the resistance was able to show the failure of the Israeli intelligence.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
One of the most important features of the confrontation waged by the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip against the Israeli attacks is that it has been characterized by a series of surprises that establish new equations that will have a profound impact on the perception of the Israeli regime's political and security institutions towards Gaza when it comes to future rules of engagement. Now, the series of surprises began with the involvement of the resistance inside Gaza directly with the Al-Quds line of events, when they issued a warning to the occupation authorities to backtrack on their Judaization attempts and repressive measures against Jerusalemites, or else things will get ugly for the occupation, and indeed they did. More details in this following report.
The starting point in the response to the Zionist Israeli aggression is that the heroics recorded by the Palestinian resistance dropped the false assessments that were repeated by the Israeli intelligence apparatus, claiming the Palestinians are far from initiating an effective and painful response in the internal Israeli settlements. The series of surprises began with the entry of Hamas and the rest of the resistance factions directly on the Al-Quds line, when they issued a warning to the occupation authorities to backtrack on their Judaization and repressive measures against Jerusalemites. The events that followed were foundational and unprecedented, as they established a new equation of deterrence inside the Palestinian territories, which Tel Aviv fears its consequences and repercussions on the entire Palestinian scene. In this position, the resistance all across Palestine was able to reconnect what was broken by the flimsy Oslo Agreement. Nevertheless, the Israeli military and intelligence minds were not ready to realize that a second shocking surprise awaited them. They did not ask the settlers gathered in Jerusalem to leave, despite the warning of the Qassam brigades. Rather, it seems that they were presuming that the limit was to launch a few rockets at the settlements surrounding the Gaza enclave. However, the first retaliatory attack from Gaza reached occupied Jerusalem, leading to utmost panic among the settlers, who are seen fleeing in every direction. The next surprise was presented by the large and synchronous missile salvos that were able to bypass Israel's missile interception system, as well as the accuracy of the hit from the first Thrash, which reflected the improvement in aiming and guidance due to the technological development that the resistance had developed. The volume of the simultaneous missile strikes reveals the fact that the size of the missile stockpile is much greater than the Israeli estimations, and the tactics adopted by the resistance showed a serious Israeli intelligence failure, as this constitutes the basis of any recommendation of military operational options, as well as failure in assessing the hostile capabilities of Israel on its southern front line with Gaza. Thus, instead of the continued Israeli attacks improving the occupation forces' image and restoring prestige, the missile retaliation deepened the leadership crisis in Tel Aviv and constituted a challenge that it could not overcome, leading it to target high residential and media towers in the Gaza Strip, hoping to deter any resistance through genocidal tactics. Here came the next resounding surprise by targeting occupied Tel Aviv and its environs through Qassam brigades and Al-Quds brigades, with dozens of missiles that were also able to bypass Israel's missile interception system and achieve accurate hits. This led to a completely new scene for Israel, where it realized that it was up to its neck in a quagmire that had not even crossed the minds of its incompetent leaders.
Now with us from Beirut is Sharmeen Narwani, independent journalist and political commentator, to talk about to us about how the Gaza resistance was able to show the world that Israel is just not that tough. Sharmeen, the series of surprises began with the entry of Hamas and the rest of the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip directly on the Al-Quds events, the events of Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Mosque. This was a first surprise that the Israelis could not really understand and fathom, as it was unprecedented. Now, was the resistance in Gaza able to establish a new equation of deterrence that will have repercussions on the entire Palestinian scene, even outside of the Gaza Strip?
To be honest, my opinion is no, not yet. The
there are two components of deterrence, the way I look at it, for in this particular situation. One is the military deterrence, and that has not been established yet. We can talk about that a bit later. Mm-hmm. But what is, I think, really critical to note, and I think many people have